Good morning, Judges Edwards, Henderson, and Williams. My name is Dawn Martin. I'm the plaintiff appellant representing myself through my law firm. Also present in the courtroom is Roberta Wright, counsel for Amicus Curiae, the National Association of Women Lawyers. The most important issues in this case revolve around the interpretation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The precedent set by this court will determine how employers and educational institutions will respond to stalking and other types of workplace and campus violence, particularly when they're directed against women. If a woman can be stalked in her workplace by a serial stalker and fired for asking her employer to take the reasonable steps to keep him out of the workplace, then women will be forced to choose between their safety and their livelihood, a Hobson's choice. The linchpin of a Title VII case is a jury's determination that when a stalker harassed me in my workplace in the hope that I would become his wife, his pursuit of me was not sexual in nature or based on my gender. This question should never have been before a jury. Judge Hogan decided it in 1999 as a matter of law based on the undisputed facts, holding that, quote,
was a decision of Judge Hogan, if I recall, rejecting a motion for summary judgment by Howard, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So presumably as a holding, that's what it added up to.
Well, he made certain determinations.
I know he said various things, but
yes.
You talk about determinations. The holding was that Howard was not entitled to summary judgment.
Correct, Your Honor. And he
identified. Are you extending law of the case doctrine, which is notoriously the weakest of the preclusion doctrines, to statements that are not holdings?
Well, Your Honor, he did make certain holdings. I'd like to quote. He said, it is clear that plaintiff was only.
He said things. I don't see how the holding is anything more than that Howard is not entitled to summary judgment on the point.
Well, he identified the specific issues that presented genuine material disputed facts that would be decided by a jury. And he said that those with respect to the sexual harassment case would be, number one, whether the harassment was severe and pervasive, and number two, whether Howard took reasonable steps to end it. And he said, based on the undisputed facts, that, quote, it is clear the plaintiff was only the object of Harris's attention because she was female. Also, it's not just my interpretation of the 1999 opinion, but in 2003, Magistrate Judge Facciola stated very clearly that it is in the brief, this exact quote, and I don't have time to take the whole quote, but he said that these are issues that will not be revisited. They were decided by Judge Hogan. They are not tribal issues of fact. He said tribal issues of fact in 1999 are still the tribal issues of fact in 2003. And he admonished Howard for raising this issue again. He said very clearly that Judge Hogan decided certain issues, as a matter of fact, which would not go before a jury. And the very first one that he stated would not be addressed by a jury was that Judge Hogan decided that Harrison's harassment was on the basis of sex. Now, not only was that a report and recommendation, but Judge Hogan adopted that in September of 2005 as an opinion of the court, and that was in the face of an objection that I filed against the adopting the report and recommendation, with a response by Howard, a reply by me, and Howard even agreeing that Judge Facciola's report and recommendation was replete with factual errors, and not objecting to Judge Hogan doing a de novo review of the motions for summary judgment. And yet Judge Hogan adopted the opinion as his own. So if there was any question, if Judge Hogan disagreed with Judge Facciola's interpretation of his decision, certainly that was the opportunity to say so. Instead, he adopted it. So I went into the trial understanding the issues that would be litigated with respect to the sexual harassment claims were, number one, that the whether the harassment rose to the level of being severe and pervasive, creating a hostile work environment for me, and number two, whether Harrison took reasonable steps to end it. And that was stated repeatedly over a six-year period in three different decisions. So to go into court, into trial, saying in 2006, these are the issues that I have to prove, and go through, and by the way, and it is, of course, in the brief, when we attempted to approach the issue of whether Dean Bullock understood my complaint of Harrison's conduct to be based on sex, Judge Hogan actually stopped the cross-examination of Dean Bullock and said, that's just not evidentiary value here. It doesn't go to prove or disprove the fact at issue. And the very fact that Judge Hogan prevented us from proving during trial turned out to be the very fact that the whole case turned on. Also, when we approached it with Officer Sirleaf, who had testified in his deposition that he perceived my complaint to be one of harassment on the basis of sex, and that was in his deposition testimony, when we approached that when he was on the stand, Judge Hogan again stopped the examination of the witness and said, that's obvious, move on, to my counsel. So not only were we told three times over a period of 6 years that this was not being an issue, but when we touched on it even in trial, Judge Hogan stopped us from proving it. And then after the trial was over, he changed all the rules and said, I'm giving this issue to the jury. And then I argued during the argument on the motions for judgment after all evidence was in that Howard should not be permitted to relitigate this issue because it had been decided in 99, and Judge Hogan said he was going to let them argue it again. So I was stuck with it on the verdict form. Then, of course, I hoped that instructions would be sufficient so that the jury would come to the same obvious conclusion that everyone else had throughout this case. But Howard's argument throughout the trial was that was to tell the jury that I was not entitled to Title VII protection because in my memoranda to Dean Bullock, I referred to Harrison, the stalker, as the stalker instead of as a sexual harasser. And that was the reason that, and I was obligated to refer to him as a sexual harasser or call the conduct sexual harassment in order to get Title VII protection. Of course, that's not the state of the law. That's not what Judge Hogan said in 99. And when I specifically asked for an instruction from Judge Hogan to take language out of his own 99 opinion and instruct the jury that you don't have to say the words sexual harassment in order to obtain Title VII protection, he refused to do that. He also refused to instruct the jury with respect to the DC stalking statute, which defines stalking as harassment. So Howard's attorney created the confusion, telling the jury that harassment and stalking were not the same thing, and that I was not credible when I claimed that I complained of sexual harassment because my memos said stalking, and apparently the jury, confused by that, brought that argument. And their question to the court reflects their confusion because they said, and I want to get the quote exactly, wives are typically female. Is the answer to 1C an automatic yes simply because the plaintiff is female? And this question reflects their common sense understanding that wife is a gender-specific term, but they had not gotten the clarification that they had requested and were confused by the definition. It's not their job to determine what constitutes sexual harassment or protected activity, but only the facts that actually occurred. And I see that I'm running out of time. So I do want to get to, once the court vacates the jury's findings that Harrison's conduct was not, court vacates the jury's finding that Harrison's conduct was not based on sex, complaints about Harrison become protected activity under Title VII. And then the court is faced with the question of whether Howard produced a legitimate non-retaliatory reason for my rejection for a permanent position or my non-renewal. The jury never reached this question. Howard's purported legitimate non-retaliatory reason has been a fraud upon the courts from the beginning. In its May 11, 2001 Official Appointments Committee statement, Howard stated that, as of December 18, 1997, Christy Cunningham had already published her article and that I had not even completed mine. In fact, Professor Cunningham's article was not published until a full year later, in the winter of 1998. And the Appointments Committee members testified that as of December 18, 1997, they all actually knew that my article was not only completed but also accepted for publication. Now, because Howard never produced any evidence of his purported legitimate non-retaliatory reason, and because the undisputed documents and Howard's own witnesses prove them to be blatantly false, I'm entitled to judgment as a matter of law on my retaliation claims.
I'm looking at the magistrate judge's ruling. I don't think it says what you're suggesting. It just says, I will not permit Howard University in its second motion for summary judgment to relitigate those issues that were resolved against it. And the trial judge merely said, I'm rejecting summary judgment. The matter goes to trial. That's all.
Your Honor, if you continue With the
tribal issues of fact in 99 remain tribal issues of fact in 2003.
Yes, and he says, more specifically, Judge Hogan concluded, number one, the alleged harassment by Harrison of the plaintiff was based on her sex. And if you continue, number two, he identifies what the questions are. He says, two, whether Harrison's conduct was sufficiently severe, pervasive to be actionable under the rubric of a hostile environment claim was a jury question. He goes on to say what the additional jury questions are. But the very first thing that he says, under more specifically, the chief judge concluded, the alleged harassment by Harrison of the plaintiff was based on her sex. With respect to the retaliation claims, I believe that I was entitled to summary judgment in 2002, judgment NOV in 2006, and a default judgment in 2002 when Howard was held in contempt of court for its extensive discovery violations. Howard delayed a trial in this case by at least 5 years, depriving me of my original trial date of May 1st, 2001. And Howard's fraud should be put to an end here and now. I respectfully request this court's de novo review of these dispositive motions and judgment as a matter of law with a remand to the trial court on the issue of damages. Thank you. I'd like to save the time for my rebuttal.
Mr.
May it please the court, my name is Brian Schwab. I represent Howard University. Mr. Cook, who is the representative of former Dean Bullock, has authorized me to speak for both appellees in this appeal. This case, like many contract and employment cases, was by its nature intensely factual, and the trial court treated it as such. After 7 years of litigation, this case came on for nearly a month-long trial in April of 2006. The jury deliberated after hearing multiple witnesses, after multiple documents, including the plaintiff's contemporaneous writings being admitted into evidence. The trial court bent over backwards to ensure that appellant had a fair trial. And at the end of that process, the jury decided, based on evidence before it, the facts at issue. It decided that the plaintiff had not proven a contract claim. Her claim that there had been a meeting of the minds with the university when she was chosen to come for a two-year visitorship that somehow allowed her a guaranteed position to continue on at the school at the end of her 2 years was rejected. There was no meeting of the minds, and there was plenty of evidence at trial as to why she didn't prove that case. The jury also had evidence with respect to the retaliation claim. There was ample evidence during the course of this long trial about what the Appointments, Promotion, and Tenure Committee considered in deciding who would be selected for the open employment opportunity and labor position. And the court also allowed evidence in front of the trial as to whether or not there had ever been a protected activity engaged in by the plaintiff when she complained about a security issue on campus.
Seems to me there are two things going on in this case. One is about an employment claim, that is, I was discriminatorily foreclosed from further position, either as a visitor or a tenure track position, and that goes to some of the contract fight. Another is a claim on sexual harassment more generally, that is, while I was there, whether or not I was entitled to stay, I was unlawfully harassed, and the gist of what I was hearing her to argue, and what appears in the brief, is that she was allegedly foreclosed from litigating a critical question as to whether the harassment was based on sex because she thought the district court had decided that question in her favor and then thereafter was precluded from proffering proof to deal with that question. So what is your response on that?
Well, we know that's not the case. If we look at the discussion with the trial court when the verdict form and the jury instructions were being discussed at the end of trial, Judge Hogan went through the jury verdict form, and one question, question 1C, dealt directly with the question of whether Mr. Harrison's conduct was because of sex or gender.
Her answer is going to be, that may well be, but in the preceding trial, I didn't know that we were litigating that, so I just want to hear what your answer is. I understand that.
But there was no objection at that time to Judge Hogan when these questions were the ones that were isolated. And, Your Honor, this was extensively pretried, this case. There were three separate pretrial conferences and a trial set to begin in January that was the night before trial postponed. The issues that were going to be tried were isolated, focused on by the parties, by the magistrate judges, and by Chief Judge Hogan before trial.
And this was one of them?
And this was
and
one of the...
what document is it shows up?
I don't know that there is a document in the record that shows that. The evidence that was introduced during the course of trial repeatedly during the plaintiff's case went to the question of...
flipping here.
What was the nature of the contact between Mr. Harrison and the plaintiff? Her memos, her discussion of the voicemail messages that were left, the nature of the contact as she described it, the witnesses she called, all offered the same testimony as to whether or not Mr. Harrison's conduct was because of sex or sexual in nature. The case was not tried any differently than it would have been. And in fact, all of the parties realized that the pretrial rulings of the court, as Judge Williams focused on, trial courts are confronting regularly motions to dismiss and motions for summary judgment. The lion's share of case law in this court on employment cases deal with whether summary judgment is appropriate. Here we have a case before this court after a full record, after a full 4-week trial. And the question of whether or not Mr. Harrison's conduct was because of sex or sexual in nature was before the jury. The jury was clearly focusing on that question. It asked the question during the note during the deliberation process. And the instruction from the trial court that, no, this is not a per se ruling, this is not a question of law, this is a factual issue you must consider and rule on based on the evidence before you, was the proper instruction. And at this stage, the question is, was the evidence so one-sided that no reasonable juror could conclude that it was not because of sex or sexual in nature? And we submit that the plaintiff, the appellant, cannot meet that burden here. There was ample evidence at trial to suggest that Mr. Harrison's conduct was based on a misidentification, that he was not acting in a sexual nature. There was nothing in his communications to the plaintiff that suggested anything of a sexual nature. The slender reed on which this case became a sexual harassment case was that he made a misidentification that he thought she was his long-lost wife. That's the only connection to this being a because of sex or gender case. And the jury saw Mr. Harrison.
Why is that enough?
Because that would, we submit, that would sweep into Title VII analysis and discrimination analysis any time.
I mean, if she'd been a man, he wouldn't have misidentified her as he did.
Well, there was evidence at trial that Mr. Harrison had stalked a man, Professor Bell. So if hypothetically it was Professor Bell's discrimination claim that Mr. Harrison stalks male professors, Professor Bell would have that same position. The law we would submit doesn't make every time a woman is the subject of a stalking or a domestic violence issue a Title VII federal anti-discrimination case. There are common law protections available. As Judge Hogan commented throughout the course of the trial, the case really ended up being tried on this theory is much more like a common law negligence premises liability. Did the university protect its professors from a trespasser? All of its community, its students, its faculty, its administrators, because of a potential criminal issue. Simply because of the misidentification, any time a woman was misidentified, one of her qualities would be her gender. But there may be a whole assortment of other factors, and here the factor was, as Mr. Harrison's subsequent letter indicated, a misidentification. The jury also had before it the contemporaneous comments of the witnesses at the time. The plaintiff never characterized this issue with Mr. Harrison as being of sexual in nature or because of gender. It didn't become a sexual harassment claim until she was challenging the APT committee's decision not to recommend her, where she was reaching for a hook for her retaliation claim. And that's where, all of a sudden, in the spring of 1998, for the very first time, the issue arose that somehow Mr. Harrison's bizarre and fleeting conduct was a sexual harassment. And the jury heard the timing of the plaintiff's claims when they were raised for the first time. They saw her memos where she never described Mr. Harrison's conduct in sexual terms or as a sexual harassment claim. Here was a woman who was making a complaint that she was a preeminent equal employment opportunity professor, having had experience at the EEOC, if anybody was sensitized to raising this as an issue of sexual harassment, it was this plaintiff. Her best friend testified during the course of trial, Ms. Garant, who was also at the EEOC. She was asked, did you ever, while these proceedings and events were occurring, consider this to be a sexual harassment claim? Did you ever urge the plaintiff to make a sexual harassment claim? She said no. Dean Bullock and Dean Newsom testified. They were asked, did you perceive this to be a sexual harassment claim? They said no. So all of this evidence was before the jury, and the jury could consider, and reasonably did consider, that the plaintiff did not prove her case on that element. The retaliation claim is, again, an attempt by appellant to bootstrap in on the sexual harassment theory into a retaliation claim. And of significance in this case, the jury found that the plaintiff was not engaged in protected activity when she made the complaint about Mr. Harrison, and equally important, that the university did not perceive her to be making a Title VII complaint, which the law says is the benchmark, the principal point in making a retaliation claim. An employer needs to know or reasonably believe that their employee is engaged in protected activity, at which point the employer cannot retaliate for that conduct. Here, the jury found that the plaintiff was not engaged in protected activity when she complained about Mr. Harrison. Contrary to the briefs, this is not a question of law. This is a question of fact. And the jury had the facts before it and decided that she had not proven her case. I need to very quickly say, because I did say to Mr. Cook I would speak for Ms. Bullock's points. One, the trial court was correct on a motion to dismiss in dismissing the intentional infliction claim. There was nothing in the complaint that would satisfy the common law standards of intentional infliction. Second, much of the attention and argument in the briefs and oral argument about Dean Bullock's alleged perjury is hyperbole. Dean Bullock was there at trial. She testified. And what the plaintiff appellant here tries to suggest is that Dean Bullock testified inconsistently at trial from a memo she had written before trial. She was subject to cross-examination. The jury heard the cross-examination. The jury resolved whatever inconsistency might be there. Unless the court has any questions for me, I will sit.
All right.
Thank you.
Ms. Barton, have any time? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes, Ms. Barton?
Could you start by saying where in your opening brief you make an argument that you were fooled into not submitting evidence on the proposition that it was sexual harassment versus something else?
Well, in my opening brief, starting on page 8, I believe, the court's very first argument is the sexual harassment claim, and I quote Judge Hogan from 99, I quote Judge Facciola from 2003.
But that's 1A is a law of the case
yes.
argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
But I don't see from the headings you're framing that as an argument that you were surprised at trial.
Yes, well, that is the point, Your Honor, of the law of the case, that you should be able to rely on the previous rulings.
No, it's a very different proposition. It's very, and you're talking about you're in the realm of harmless error. Lots of case law to suggest that if, in fact, this was tried
yes.
and it was presented, whatever your thoughts were about what the trial judges did become moot if you're
yes.
wrong on that. So what Judge Williams is asking is something I'd like to know, too. Where is it that you're making the argument that almost a due process kind of argument,
yes.
you were foreclosed from trying the case on these terms?
Yes,
I didn't see the argument either.
Actually, I do use the words due process in the brief, and I use those exact words. At the moment, I would lose all my time trying to get that vote, if I can come back to it, and perhaps my paralegal can look for that. But I do absolutely use the words due process.
No, I'm asking whether you made the argument that you were foreclosed from trying the issue, which was clearly tried. Lots of testimony on it. Where is it you say, don't be fooled, I was foreclosed from trying this, and I was shocked at the end of trial that this was an issue? Where is that? Because if that was an argument, you're an attorney, that would be one of the first things you would say
yes.
and have a heading probably to say it.
I did make that argument. I did point out that Dean Bullock's testimony was cut off, and I would like to address that first to follow up on Judge Williams' question. With respect to Dean Bullock's perjury, her words in her July 1st, 1999 memo to her own general counsel in response to my EEOC charge, in which, by the way, they never alleged where they were charged at the EEOC with sexual harassment. They never alleged that it wasn't a sexual harassment case. Instead, they tried to claim that they took reasonable measures to stop it, and there are additional false statements made by Dean Bullock in that EEOC position statement, wherein she says that she had enlisted the assistance of Lawrence Dawson to help her address it, and he was working on it, and they took that position. Howard responded with that answer in answers to interrogatory, and when I was finally permitted to depose Lawrence Dawson in 2002, he testified, which he did again testify at a trial, that Dean Bullock never discussed it with him, never told him anything about it. He was not involved in it at all, and Dean Bullock admitted that that was the case, that she had never talked to him or anyone else in campus security while she had written to me a memo stating that she was discussing the matter with Lawrence Dawson to try to provide me with protection. And that was one of the reasons that I didn't immediately file an EEO charge, because it's not an EEO case against the employer unless and until the employer does not take the reasonable steps. It is third-party harassment, and the reporting procedures are very different.
Let me stop you, because you're over your time. You need to respond. Has your question been answered?
Yes. I focused on it in the reply brief in response to Howard's argument. And I do specifically, here's...
So you're saying it was not a principal claim in your opening brief?
It was, Your Honor.
I'm looking at your opening brief, and there are a lot of headings, and this is not one of them.
It was within the law of the case argument, because the fact that there were these three decisions over a period of 6 years, and Judge Facciola's decision does make it very plain, identifying what issues will be tried, I relied on that going into the trial. And Officer Sirleaf was cut off, Dean Bullock was cut off, when my attorneys attempted to question them on this issue. And Judge Hogan even said during the trial, it's obvious, move on that point. So having been told it's obvious and to move on and away from it, and being told again to move away from it when Dean Bullock was being questioned, there was no opportunity to confront her with it. And many witnesses were impeached with their deposition testimony, and there were issues with respect to time, because Howard was permitted to put its defense on during my case in chief, and my case in chief was completely usurped from me and controlled by Howard. And so I did not have the time. I had to constantly rebut Howard's arguments in the middle of my case in chief. So we had to make some decisions at the end with respect to what issues we were going to come back to and really impeach the witnesses on. And because we had been told that this was not going to be an issue that had already been resolved back in 99 and affirmed in 2003 and 2005, that's not an issue that we focused on impeachment. We did impeach.
Edwards, do you have any other questions? All right, Judge Williams, your time.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.